You're listening to Expansion on republicbroadcasting.org. This is Sophia, your host, and I have to say it's Friday again, and I see a lovely big chemtrail outside my window with horizontal stripes. So I guess we are in our current reality that is being foisted on us, that we have to figure out how to ascend out of. I want to introduce today's subject by way of an update on an announcement I made at the beginning of last week's show, which was that All Is One Heart Song, with whom I did an interview in early October, I believe it was October 3rd, and it was one of the few interviews he ever gave in his life. He was 80 years old, and he continues to be a phenomenal spirit now. He passed away during a thunderstorm. I was given a little more information, and it's very interesting because All Is One was very excited about the planetary ascension, which he believed would occur in 2012. He was looking forward to it. He taught me to embrace this development that all of us are heading into and not be afraid of it, not be afraid of the chaos that is clearly leading up to it. He said all one needs to do is embrace planetary ascension and participate in it. So I was very surprised that All Is One disappeared from the Earth before 2012. And I learned that on Saturday night, he died on November 8th, Saturday. And this was the evening of a very huge thunderstorm in Mount Shasta, where he lived, which apparently is not usual at this time of year, or perhaps not even usual at all. But anyway, there was a tremendous storm, and All Is One, who is a regular journaler, he even told me that he journaled his emails, if you can believe it. I think that's what he said. He wrote in his journal fanatically, and there was only on November 8th one entry at 6:30 at night, and it had one word. The word was thunderstorm. And All Is One was discovered lying on the floor with his arms folded and a very peaceful smile on his face. And he hadn't fallen. He had lain himself down. That is the correct English, lain, L-A-I-N. And a friend of mine who told me this said that it's very possible that a giant electromagnetic force came and took All Is One with it. And that gives me goosebumps, loads and loads of goosebumps. When I talk about it, I'm covered with goosebumps right now. I think that could be very true. And that is the introduction that I'm making to today's subject, which is HARP, electromagnetism, the mind control aspects of HARP, the powerful, amazing energy that HARP contains that could be used to benefit us, that could be used to bring humanity into full potential, but this current version of HARP is doing the opposite. So I'm going to bring our two guests back at the end of the break, Alfred Weber and Lorraine Murray. You're listening to Expansion on republicbroadcasting.org, the RBN Network, and this is Sophia, your host, and I'm happy to reintroduce our guest, Alfred Weber, and hopefully we'll be able to get Lorraine Murray back as well today. But Alfred is, I think, on the line with us. Are you there, Alfred?
Yes, I am.
How are you?
Excellent. Yeah, great.
Alfred, what did you think of that introduction of the electromagnetic storm?
Well, once one gets into the science of the soul, and the physics of the end of the interdimensional universe, the data there, and I'll use the word data there, are very very interesting. There are reports, for example, of of extraterrestrial craft, of upper dimensional extraterrestrial craft that are loaded with souls.
With souls?
Yeah. Yes.
And what are souls, Alfred?
Well, if you if you look at yourself, for example, you know, or any one of our fellow 6 billion human beings, we're actually multidimensional time-space navigating units. If we're willing, just for purposes of answering this question and exploring this topic, to discard or look beyond the Western medical model, we are far more than the carbon unit or the biological mechanism known as our body, and that is known as our physical body. And this is now being confirmed more and more by science, by the scientific method, rather. And of course, it has been long known in ancient sciences, the sciences of the ancient cultures, be it Chinese traditional medicine, or be it Vedic medicine, Ayurvedic medicine, or any of the traditional medicines. And this is getting to answer your question, what is the soul? I'm kind of unpacking the various layers of what we are as a human being, because what you see when you encounter the body of a human being is like encountering the tip of an iceberg, literally. And that iceberg can be massive. Can be massive and can stretch many, many light years.
One person?
Yes.
Okay, so one person is like a package of something that transcends or that extends rather way beyond the physical body. That is, you said it was a time and space traveling entity.
Yes.
So, okay. So these souls, they come and they inhabit one of us. Or how does the soul choose a body?
Yes. Yes. Right. Now, well, first of all, our physical body is just one layer of the container, of the multidimensional container and mechanism. That a soul inhabits. They are many, many layers. There's a to a body. There's an electromagnetic body called the aura, and this can be proven through various mechanisms. Curlian photography is one, which is a form of photography which demonstrates that each human being is surrounded by an electromagnetic field that is actually emanates from that person and is organically connected to biological and psychological processes that emanate from that person.
Okay, so now I want to tie this with the topic of our show today, if it's not premature to do so. It seems to me what you're saying is we are electromagnetic. That's kind of the organization of us. That's the space that we occupy. It's electromagnetically colored. It is electromagnetism. So this harp thing that we're talking about, which uses electromagnetism, it has the capacity then, I would assume, to affect us profoundly on levels that aren't even just physical. Yeah?
Well, they're physical, but they're not visible. And because the electromagnetic spectrum, the visible part of the electromagnetic spectrum is a very narrow portion, but HARP represents a weaponization or a destructive use of the electromagnetic spectrum. And,
okay.
And what it represents is taking a part of the electromagnetic components of the biosphere, namely the ionosphere, which is the one of the uppermost components of the upper atmosphere, that bordering on space. That component of the biosphere, which is nearest to space, and weaponizing it, taking that electromagnetism and weaponizing it. The analogy would be, and this is a rough analogy, is that if you take human cells and turn them into cancer cells to be used against the body, but that's just a rough analogy. You're using a natural system, an environmental system, namely the ionosphere, as a weapon, as a source of electromagnetism that then can be applied in a whole number of applications because we live in a universe that, in essence, is a sea of electromagnetism.
Right. That's what I was trying to express. That the medium in which we live is electromagnetic, and we are, and parts of us that we don't even know how to define or explain, like our soul or spirit, is, from what you're saying, also electromagnetic, right?
Well, parts of our... Put it this way, there's our physical body, there are various electromagnetic bodies, more refined bodies in terms of our aura, our etheric bodies, which have very complicated valves on them called chakras, which in turn connect up with universal energy circuits. So we are like complex energy machines navigating through the electromagnetic spectrum. But we just see this picture of bodies walking through the autumn leaves as they fall. Because that's the way that nature has designed our physical bodies. And the visible spectrum that we see. But if we actually get into our etheric bodies, then there's a whole larger world in which we live, in which we have etheric bodies that relate to a much wider and broader portion of the electromagnetic spectrum, and which are drawing upon much farther reaches, both on the planet and off planet. Once you get into, for example, there is a model called the psi-mediated instrumental response model.
Okay, and before we discuss that, can I ask you a question, Alfred?
Yeah.
All right. When you start talking about the etheric body, I find myself, it's not really shutting down, but it's disengaging, because I see and hear the people in the New Age movement talking about this kind of thing all the time. And what I'm trying to create by the show and my own life and my own curiosity and exploration is a way to...
Well then call it the electromagnetic body.
Okay, well that to me, maybe it sounds more technical. I'm trying to explore my own resistance to something that I know there's a big movement, this New Age movement, that I do not consider that I belong to for certain reasons.
Well, the etheric body is not New Age. That's an ancient term from the Vedic sciences.
Okay, we're going to be into our break in a second, and we'll be back in the next 3 minutes. You're listening to Expansion on RepublicBroadcasting.org. This is Sophia, your host, and my guest today is Alfred Weber. We're still trying to connect with Lorraine Murray. She was to join Alfred, and maybe she will in the later hour of this show. Anyway, Alfred, we were talking about the etheric body, and I was objecting to New Age terms, and I was more ready to call it the electromagnetic body, which reveals a sort of prejudice on my part, I must say. So that's what I'm trying to explore, because I believe that there is a division between people who are politically aware and awake and people who are... you just could call it metaphysically, some call it spiritually, growing, and they don't share the same platform of experience even. And somehow those two levels those two, like, worlds in which these respective groups live might be merged for much more understanding of what is really going on and what is possible given what's going on. Do you understand what I'm saying?
Sure. Yeah. Well, I think, let's see if we can evolve an idiom which might be a bridge. Strictly speaking, the physical body is an electromagnetic body, because we know that most of what you're looking at when you look at your arm and look at your hand, I'm sitting here looking at my hand now, and we know that it's mostly empty space. And it's composed of atoms and electrons, and these are which array in electromagnetic patterns, and it's those patterns which reflect back and are interpreted by my eye as a hand, so that my physical body is an electromagnetic body in a certain frequency mode. Let's just call it that way to keep it, you know, kind of a generic description. Well, there are other electromagnetic bodies that are also part of me and part of all humans. It's standard operating equipment that we have. And these have other names. The other names that we have are what you say might be New Agey. And so we have to find other names for the electromagnetic body known as the aura. But
okay,
there's a long history of aura photography through Curlian photography. And
okay,
if you go to the American Journal of Psychical Research, you'll see very, very elaborate scientific experiments that, you know, photograph the aura, or photograph that particular electromagnetic body and correlate it to all sorts of moods and shifts and changes. And you've heard of the term indigo children.
Yes.
These are the 20 to 30-year-olds. Well, that's because they come in with the indigo auras. And so you get into a whole color-based system. And people are actually, if you could see the world rather than seeing people's bodies, but seeing their auras, which is what people who are more psychically sensitive do, then you would walk around and you would see an entirely different dimension of people. And,
right,
you know, and you could tell, you could go further into the person just by coming into contact with them, more than coming into contact with their body. You say, oh, I'm reading your body language. Well, subconsciously, you might be reading their aura.
Well, again, this is about generalizing. When to go back to something you said earlier, when you say that the eye looks at the hand and reads it as a hand rather than this universe of empty space and particles racing around, that's a generalization. The eye is seeing, the eye is choosing to see certain frequencies and register those frequencies within the brain, and that's called the hand, and we're taught to generalize in that way as a, almost as a social process. I have to tell you, I have seen an aura. I had a friend once, and I looked at her and I said, oh my God, I see your aura. I saw her surrounded by this brilliant, bright cerulean blue. It was like light radiating from her, and that was the first and only time I've ever seen it, and I know I wasn't mistaken. I knew exactly what it was, and I don't know why I only saw it once in my whole life, but I did. So I can believe that.
So you were then, you were experiencing a part of her multidimensional self, and there are other parts of her multidimensional self. Wherein resides the mind. In other words, each of us has a mind. It's not an abstraction. It's a physical thing. It's just in a different part of the electromagnetic spectrum.
All right, well, we have another short break, and I would be very interested to continue after the break. You're listening to Expansion on Republic Broadcasting, the RBN Network. The URL is republicbroadcasting.org. This is Sophia, your host, and we are in a conversation, Alfred Weber and I. Alfred is back for, I think, his third time. And, Alfred, I have to say I find you extremely fascinating because you happen to know so much about so many things, and you have a very patient, kind way of explaining and steering me or guiding, I should say, guiding me through my objections, which I am noting as we talk, because everyone has resistance to certain kinds of descriptions because of what they think is preferable to align with and what they don't want to accept. And I notice this, you know, in my experience trying to wake people up to all the rabbit holes, as I call them. But sometimes it's simply a matter of languaging and finding the right path. So you were talking about the mind. And you were explaining that the mind is just another, and you used the word distant part of the electromagnetism of a being. Am I right in repeating it that way?
Yeah, I may have said distinct.
Oh, distinct. Okay,
yeah.
Sorry.
Yeah, because in Western philosophy, they say, oh, that's a mind-body problem. Making a distinction or a separation between mind and body. Well, no, the mind is part of the body. It's just not part of what we call the physical body, i.e., this two-legged humanoid part. The two-legged humanoid part is, think of it as our space suit. For
a space suit?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, they're, you know, as though we were on the moon or on Mars. You know, and so you land on the moon and remember those, the kind of the classic space suits?
Yes.
That astronauts wear? Well, you've got 6 or 7 billion people wearing 6 or 7 billion space suits. That's what our deeper bodies need to survive the conditions of this planet. We have bio space suits. Bio space suit.
Okay, now I'm going to dissect another word here because it's going to help me understand. You said to survive the conditions on this planet, as though those are hostile conditions. But could I choose the word to experience?
Oh, sure. To experience this planet. Yeah, you're right. That's a better term. To experience this planet, we experience it. One of the things that we use is this biospace suit that in our conventional trance we call our body.
Okay, now I'm gonna say one thing and then jump on another word you use. Hopefully my brain can remember both at once. All right, so I would say that the biophysical or biological spacesuit that we wear is necessary or is the vehicle that connects us to the ecosystem of the planet. Because were we something else, for instance, anything inorganic, or were we just spirits, disembodied, we wouldn't have a connection, a working connection with oxygen, with flora, fauna, which actually serves to feed us, right? So we need this physical suit in order to be linked up with everything else in this experience.
Yes, and that's the whole miracle of incarnation. Incarnation,
okay.
i.e. and reincarnation, i.e. this is like someone I know, a close, says, we got the e-ticket in the carnival ride, i.e. one way to look at incarnation on planet Earth or any other incarnation is as a carnival ride or a school. These are what traditional religious concepts say, that incarnation is a school. It's a school for souls. In fact, the entire universe is a school for souls, that the whole purpose of the universe is actually a greenhouse and a school for souls. And it's this elaborate mechanism for the deepest part, which we haven't reached yet, the deepest part of our bodies, which is the soul body, which is an entity that is outside of time-space.
Okay, now when you say we haven't reached it, you mean that...
We haven't reached it in our discussion.
Oh, okay. Well, that's what I was going to try to clarify. Is it in our conversation we haven't reached it, or...
In our conversation today, we've just begun to touch on it with the subject of incarnation, i.e., there's the physical process of biological propagation, whereby either in vivo, there's in vivo or in vitro fertilization, and babies are born, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And generations go forward, and families propagate, and generations flourish. Well, behind that, there is a whole hidden drama, which some cultures, which religions try to interpret what they call through a glass darkly, because religion is not science-based, it's belief-based, and therefore imperfect. And what is occurring in that area that now science is starting to explore is that for each body represents a deeper self that is coming into this earthly experience, into this dimension, into this spacesuit, to experience and add to its enrichment in its universe career. In other words, there's a multi-level experience going on here, and we're now in our Earth classroom. And that's what's so. And if we're having World War III or World War II, we're just killing ourselves.
Right.
I.e., it's the same group of souls, the human community of souls, that's killing each other. We're constantly going around and killing each other.
Okay, tell me this, since you might be the only person who has the answer to this. way back when the earth was young, there weren't that many souls walking around. And now we have over 6 billion, maybe close to 7 billion. So where are these all souls, separate souls? Where are they all coming from?
Well,
how many more are there?
Yeah, that's a very interesting question. And that you see, there's an interface between exopolitics and what I would call parapsychology or spiritual science. In other words, the science of the soul and the science of relations between art, civilization, and the multiplicity of dimensional civilizations in the universe. This is all related, and it all depends on the model of the universe that one has. That is, what was one before one came into a body, and quote, where does one go after one leaves this body? That's the essence of it. And we have actual reports in exopolitics, which is the new political science of outer space, of people who are taking aboard spacecraft where they encounter, quote, their dead relatives. So these are some of the data points in science that we are now attempting to answer these questions.
Okay, well, I'm going to say something, which is that if I, you know, what you're describing also is similar to the tunnel and the light. When you have an NDE, near-death experience,
people
report going into a tunnel, and often very fast, and there's light at the end, and they get into this brilliant field of light, and they often describe paradisical flowers, things like this, and all their dead relatives. So let's just say that the spacecraft with the dead relatives and the tunnel of light, those are the same thing somehow. And I couldn't even begin to imagine how they're the same, but for this discussion, I'll assume that they're the same. So now we're seeing our relatives who are gone. So they are presumably disembodied. But why are we seeing them in their bodies again? Is this just another form of recognition that's registering in an experiential sense? Or what is it? Why do they look like relatives?
This is where we have to speak very tentatively, because some of the textbooks in this field are books like 30 Years Among the Dead, you know, of the person who died and spent 30 years among the dead and then came back and is writing about it.
Who is that person? Is there such a book, I'm assuming, right?
Yeah.
And who's the author?
I can't recall it now, but for example, there's the works of Dr. Ian Stevenson at the University of Virginia Medical School, who studies the phenomenon of reincarnation. And some of his books are, for example, 20 Cases Suggestive of Reincarnation. So that there is a whole field which is interrelated with the field of exopolitics, which is now studying, I would say, to get it back to the topic of the show, I realize that we've gone far afield.
No, I don't think so.
Oh, okay.
Oh, by the way, I Googled the 30 Years Among the Dead. It's Carl Wicklund.
Yes.
Carl August Wicklund, Wickland. Wicklund, M.D. And it's also, it can be downloaded. So just Google it. Yeah, you can buy it on Amazon. So anyway, for those who are interested.
Okay, good. And so, in a way, this is to tie it into the topic. These are further studies of the electromagnetic spectrum, because what we call life is what we call, oh, that's the experience of being in our physical bodies in a very defined portion of the electromagnetic spectrum for a very defined portion of time-space. But we exist outside of time-space. Our deeper, deepest portion of self, of the self, the soul, exists outside of time-space in a subspace dimension. And we have a multi-dimensional career in the universe, which various religions, try to define. If you look at the Christian religion, for example, they have a very simplistic model of heaven and hell. You know, you get one chance at bat, and you either go to heaven or you go to hell. That really apparently has nothing to do with the historical person of Jesus, but more the political and psychological manipulations of the Christian, of the Catholic and the Christian organizations, you know, the religious organizations. If you look at more the Eastern religions, for example, Tibetan Buddhism, and the way that it has opened itself up to being examined by science, notably with all of the psychological studies. There have been many psychological studies that have been welcomed by the Tibetan Buddhist area. The Tibetan Buddhist model may be more accurate, although it, you know, again, that's a very ancient science, and may be an antediluvian science that goes back before some of the great earth traumas that we suffered over the last, 13,000 years or so.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, so how do we bring this back to the manipulation of electromagnetism in such a way that it is hurting us into submission and even oblivion, rather than expanding our possibilities and uniting us in whatever, productivity and bliss and all that good stuff?
Right, right. Okay. Well, I think that, first of all, what I'd like to do is to maintain this level of awareness before going back into the 9/11 area, and to say that my analysis has led me to believe that the powers behind 9/11, and there are various terms for them, the International War Crimes Racketeering Organization, the cabal, they're just different terms. Each term is not fully adequate.
Okay.
There's the music. We'll come
music.
Back on the other end.
Yes, we'll be back in 3 minutes. You're listening to Expansion on republicbroadcasting.org. This is Sophia, your host. And I am speaking today with Alfred Weber, and we're trying to meander back into the area of HAARP, or rather the utilization of force in the electromagnetic spectrum, or capability in the electromagnetic spectrum, such that it is impairing our well-being rather than enhancing it. Oh, Alfred.
Right. You know, and through the miracle of synchronicity, during the break, Lorraine Murray came online on Skype.
Yeah.
And so I asked her immediately to call RBN. So she should be calling RBN right now on Skype.
Okay.
So she'll be joining us for the second hour, which is good, because she has prepared an extensive outline that goes in detail onto the specific applications of HAARP at the World Trade Center, and shows that the footprint of the event that occurred at the World Trade Center as a matter of science corresponds to the footprint corresponds to an electromagnetic event, not to an explosive event.
Okay.
Yeah. So now I don't know. What we can do, Sister Sophia, it just can continue. Oh, it says Loren is saying the phone access is blocked. I just get a busy signal. Is there another phone that she should call, or?
Well, let's try to figure that out in our next break. So we'll have a short break, and then I will try to get Loren on the line myself so that we can continue this. So we have just three or four minutes, and is there anything you want to say before we... I know that certain listeners are interested to hear how HAARP was the agent of destruction at the World Trade Center, because I received some emails this week, so that'll be good. And...
Right.
Yes. So is there anything that we should establish about HAARP or electromagnetism as an introduction to that?
Yes. if we go and look at what occurred on September 11th, 2001. First of all, one of the key factors is that the seismic record, that is, there are various seismic laboratories around in New York City. I know that there's a seismic laboratory here's the thing. Let me just say that Loren is saying she's trying to call 800-313-9443.
Yes, we'll figure it out.
And is so, busy.
Yes.
And it's
all
busy.
Right, we'll get her on. Don't worry.
Okay.
We have a couple of minutes of break, and we'll be back.
Okay, great.
You're listening to Expansion on republicbroadcasting.org, the RBN network, and this is Sophia, your host, and we're entering our second hour. We finally have Loren Murray back with us for this show. We were with Alfred Weber the first hour, and now I think Loren is on the line. Are you, Loren?
Yes. Good morning, Sophia.
Yes, nice to have you here. I was a bit worried that we wouldn't be able to get you today. So anyway,
right.
Alfred and I discussed a lot about electromagnetism in the first hour, and he said that you had prepared quite an outline about this topic in connection with the demolition, and I use that word in an umbrella sense, a generic sense, the demolition of the Twin Towers on September 11th. So how would you like to begin, Loren, since we can devote much of this next hour to your work?
Well, I really appreciate you and Alfred discussing the energy issue, the electromagnetic issue. We can call it the energy budget, and that is the very key to understanding what happened at the World Trade Center on 9/11. And there are many aspects of the energy budget that can be looked at, and each of them gives us more information or clues about what really happened. The the seismic record for the collapse of the World Trade Center buildings is number one, and the seismic record does not reflect the amount of material and the seismic impact that should have had from those two very robust buildings coming down. And I believe on the seismic record, there was nothing recorded that was probably stronger than a quarry blast. And the impact of those two buildings coming down was certainly much greater than that. The kinetic energy that was involved or should have been expressed when those buildings came down should have been on the seismic record, and the kinetic energy is basically all of the energy that went into building or constructing those two buildings and lifting all those materials as high as 100 or maybe 115 stories. And when a building collapses, all of the energy that went into lifting or moving all those materials up to different heights on each floor would have been released. And we know the buildings came down in 8 or 10 seconds, almost the speed of gravity. So that would have made a huge impact. And it's nowhere on the seismic record. So that's a very important number one clue. Where did all that energy disappear to? What happened to that? And then the other clue that's very important is that the size of the dust particles and the material that was released as the buildings went down required tremendous amounts of energy to produce those very tiny particles, to break all the chemical bonds that in the building materials and the cement and everything involved in the building. The very strong steel girders and beams, and what in the world? Where did that energy come from? It was actually greater.
Okay, we are into our break, and we will be back.
Involved.
You're listening to Expansion on Republic Broadcasting, the RBN Network, and we are launching our second hour now with Lorraine Murray and Alfred Weber, who was with us on the first hour. And Lorraine has been explaining the relationship between electromagnetism as a form of destruction, or the form, actually, at the World Trade Center, and the record of seismic activity and other evidence that we have. Now, Lorraine, is there more that you want to cover, or can we go back and discuss some of these things? How are you going to introduce all this material?
Well, I think I should go through it, and then we can talk about it, because I'll never get through it if we start discussing the fine details.
Okay, that's
fine.
So
let me get through this, and then we can have a discussion.
Okay, good.
So the amount of energy that would have been needed to break the molecular bonds of all the materials that went into the building was much, much greater than the kinetic energy that was involved in constructing the building. And so you have a big energy budget discrepancy here that has to be explained. And this is where any discussion about what happened at the WTC, or if beam weapons or exotic weapons or HARP were used, it has to start with the energy budget. And already we have a tremendous discrepancy in energy needed to carry out what happened there right from the very beginning, starting with the seismic record. Now, when the buildings are being taken down, it was obviously not a controlled demolition. the buildings just really basically erupted into an emulsion of dust particles. And there was no rubble that hit the ground. If you watch the videos, many videos were taken. It just looks like a drinking fountain of dust from the top of the building down. And much of the dust went directly up into the atmosphere. And there are actually satellite images showing the dust going into the upper atmosphere immediately. And that is defying gravity for anything, any particles that are larger than a tenth of a micron, which indicates that those particles escaping into the atmosphere were actually nanoparticle sized, which is a tenth of a micron, and they do not are not influenced by gravitational forces. Now, the another clue is that the detritus of the rubble pile from the collapse of a controlled demolition is usually about one-third the height of the building. So there should have been a rubble pile in the case of those two buildings. I think one was 100 feet, and the other one was 115. So there should have been a rubble pile that was over 30 stories high. And also, there were buildings very closely located right next to the World Trade Center buildings, and there was absolutely no damage done to them. Now, a clue as to what happened or what might have influenced the size of the particles released in the collapse of the building is that in photos, aerial photos and satellite photos, the footprint of the World Trade Center buildings is that you could see in the footprint that it was bare dirt. There was no rubble pile there at all. And there were perfectly geometrically round holes 24 feet in diameter in the footprints. And this is evidence of a beam weapon. And I actually saw something like this demonstrated in Livermore in about 1990 when I was a staff scientist at the Livermore lab. And they actually secretly developed HAARP at Livermore with the Soviet Union beginning in 1976. So that was the year of the 200th anniversary of the United States. And even though we were in a Cold War with the Soviet Union, we were secretly developing what basically is the next Manhattan Project with the Soviet Union. And even in 1955, there were microwave ovens and beam weapons under development. The laser project at Livermore is called SHIVA, and they developed beam weapons there. Now, when I was watching this demonstration in the middle of the night, they had diverted air traffic 5 miles for a 5-mile radius around Livermore. And I had a young physics grad student staying with me that summer. He came and woke me up and said, come outside and watch this demonstration. This is coming from the laser facility, and it was about a 15 or 16 foot diameter amber-colored beam going straight up into the sky, into the heavens. And I said, what in the world is that? And he said, I said, what are they doing? And he said, they're doing an experiment, and they're trying to create a star. Well, I knew that was a cover story, because lasers are used to carry out molecular dissociation. It's not to bring materials together, they're for destructive purposes. And also, in some of the news clips where they were interviewing firemen, one of them was talking about the building came down and the antenna that was on top of building one, which came down last, he said it was at the first story on the ground. So where did 99 stories disappear to? They just completely disappeared, and it absolutely defies the laws of gravity. Another clue that a beam weapon might have been used is that on Liberty Street, which was near the World Trade Center building, there was a mysterious 60-foot hole in the ground with no explanation about what caused it. No one even discussed it. So I think there's quite a lot of evidence, physical evidence, including the seismic record and the kinetic energy involved, to indicate that something very strange happened there. Now, in watching the building coming down, the two buildings coming down, there was sort of a smoke chimney going up into the atmosphere, but there was sort of a dust cover draped down the sides of the buildings, and so some larger particles were falling. Those had to be larger than a tenth of a micron, and but they were still very, very fine dust. And when the buildings had completely collapsed, that dust cloud draping along the sides of the buildings spread out into the streets just a certain distance, and then it stopped, and then suddenly it started vaporizing up into the atmosphere. So that is another clue that particles that were heavy enough to fall were transformed into smaller particles, nano-sized particles that would no longer be subjected to gravitational forces. And that dust cover of when the buildings are coming down is really very strange, you know, to suddenly start vaporizing up into the atmosphere. That required energy also to break those larger particles into much smaller particles. Now, a human hair is the diameter of about 80 microns, and a tenth of a micron is smaller than bacteria or viruses. That's an awful lot of material just in one dust particle. That's a lot of molecular bonds to break to reduce an 80-micron particle into a tenth of a micron or even smaller. Now, another very strange thing is that when you watch videos of the buildings, especially Building 7, huge amounts of paper come flying out of the windows, just pouring out of the windows, and but there are no fires inside. And the paper was lying all over the streets and all over the ground, and even in areas where 1,400 cars were toasted. In other words, the paper.
All right, we are disappearing into our break, and we'll be back in 3 minutes to hear more of this analysis. We're listening to Expansion on Republic Broadcasting, and I'm Sophia, your host, and we're in our second hour with Lorraine Murray explaining about electromagnetism used as the method of demolishing the Twin Towers. Lorraine, we had said last week that we were going to take callers today, and we do actually have a caller, so I don't know how far you are into your explanation or whether when you want to take a caller.
Third of the way, so I'd like to finish this and then take callers, if that's okay.
Okay, well, we only have basically a half hour left, so we may not even be able to do that.
Okay.
All right, but let's go ahead then.
Okay, so what occurred is that there were 1,400 cars in sort of parking lots two blocks from the World Trade Center building. And in video clips and photos of these cars, they had been attacked with something for sure. The door handles were missing. There was paint blistered, or the paint was burned off, but not on the whole car, just parts of it, and fresh paint on other parts left. But very mysteriously, the engine blocks were missing from the cars. And you could see a horizontal hole through from the front of the one side of the car to through the engine area to the other side. And if you look through this hole, the engine was completely missing in car after car. It was really bizarre. And the engines had not been removed from the cars. They just disappeared. And that's very odd because there was paper lying all over on the ground. So you have this mystery of how paper, which is a very fragile material and ignites at very low temperature, was completely untouched. And yet iron and metal and paint and windows in these vehicles, the windows were just missing. What in the world physically happened that could create a phenomenon like this? And I don't have an answer. I don't know what happened. But in another clip, a reporter or two reporters were walking down a street, and in the distance, you could see a whole pile of cars parked there. And they just, all of them spontaneously combusted at one time. It wasn't one fire starting in one car and spreading to the others. It was all of them just went up in flames. So some very new and very different technology certainly was used. Another indicator is that rust appeared immediately on the cars, on the trucks, and on the beams in the World Trade Center buildings that were on the ground. And in FEMA photos, you can see very bright red rust on the steel beams of the World Trade Center collapsed buildings. And steel doesn't rust. So what in the world caused this chemical reaction on the beams? No one has ever explained that. Now, also, in the basements of the buildings, if those two buildings had collapsed in a free fall, as we're led to believe by the news media, why were the basements of the buildings undamaged? There were even mannequins or life-size characters dressed up in clothing in the basement of one of the buildings, and they were carried out of the building completely unharmed. Also, a street trolley or some kind of public transit trains were buried in the basement or under the basement of one of the buildings, and they brought those out completely unharmed. So that's also very mysterious. Now, Dr. Cahill, Thomas Cahill from UC Davis, he's a retired professor now, but he helped co-found the Delta Group, which is a consortium of international scientists who study atmospheric pollution all over the world, and they use lasers to analyze the content of the atmosphere in pollution clouds over cities or wherever they want to study it. And he was asked by a member of the Department of Energy to do air monitoring at the World Trade Center beginning on about October 5th of 2001. And he did it without receiving any funding for it. So basically, all of the, it was his own private study. And he was asked, because he has very, very sophisticated air monitoring equipment, and with very small particles, you cannot capture them in filters. They go right through filters. So you have to use a very different equipment, which he has.
All right, we're into our next break, and we'll be back in 3 minutes. You're listening to Expansion on Republic Broadcasting, the RBN Network. This is Sophia, your host, and we are listening to Lorraine Murray recount the many bits of evidence that suggest or point to electromagnetism as the demolition force at the World Trade Center in 2001 rather than explosives. And Lorraine, you know, I am itching to ask you questions because as you are explaining this, there are so many things I'm hearing that do not connect with my own experience. I did make the video 9/11 Mysteries. I was immersed in this research for years, and I've spoken to people who lived in New York and were at the Twin Towers and were first responders, and I myself have seen video upon video upon video. And not to say that I'm disagreeing, but there is so much to discuss here, and I know that we have callers, so I'm hoping that we'll be able to make our way through this to ask you some very pertinent questions.
Okay, well, let me just finish. Now, Dr. Cahill did a very, very good job with the air monitoring, which he continued into December. So he was doing it for about 3 months. And I told Christopher Boland, who is one of the best 9/11 investigative journalists, about Dr. Cahill's findings. And he actually went to UC Davis and spent several days with Dr. Cahill. And he brought back the report that Dr. Cahill wrote, which was about 2 inches thick, and I went over it with him. And it does provide an explanation of this mystery about why the hardest materials at the World Trade Center location were vaporized and disappeared into the atmosphere, but the most fragile material, paper, was left undamaged on the ground. And what Dr. Cahill said about nanoparticles is, I'm quoting him now, these size particles travel like a gas. They penetrate windows, doors, everywhere. You don't feel it and you can't see it. He predicted that the health impact from the World Trade Center attack will continue indefinitely. Regrettably, what we have here is a human experiment on a grand scale. And then he reported the EPA and the USGS were also involved in analyzing the dust samples, but they did a very poor job. And what he reported in his monitoring was 4 categories of material. He said there were fine and very fine transition metals, which interfere with lung chemistry and a lot more than that in your health. 2 acids, in this case sulfuric acid, which attack cilia and lung cells directly. 3 very fine undissolvable or insoluble particles, in this case glass, which travel through the lungs to the bloodstream and heart. And 4 high-temperature organic matter, many components of which are known to be carcinogens. And then in summary, he said, for each of these 4 classes of pollutant, we recorded the highest levels we have ever seen in over 7,000 measurements we have made of very fine air pollution throughout the world, including Kuwait and China. So that's even more very damning evidence that huge amounts of energy were required to reduce the building material into such fine particles. Now, another very strange phenomenon, and this is from SEMA aerial photos, is that beginning on 9/11, there were 130 dump trucks photographed going in and out of New York City, and also there was extensive scrubbing of the streets, and this is when people should have been rescued. They were out there scrubbing the streets around the World Trade Center. What were they washing away? And in the aerial photos, you couldn't tell if you were standing on the ground, but the dump trucks had dirt or soil in them with tarps over them, and they were loaded up to the edge of the top of the dump truck, but not higher so that people couldn't see that there was soil being brought into New York City. And the dump trucks were coming in and bringing soil and spreading it all over the World Trade Center area, and over a week's time, the piles got higher and higher, and then they would excavate all of it, remove it, put it in the dump trucks, and take it out and bring more in. And what was very evident in photos is that there was a lot of fuming on the ground, fumes coming up off the surface of the ground without any explanation. It was not fires. Fuming disappeared during rainy days. And if fires were burning, as they said they burned under the buildings for 99 days, the smoke still would have been coming out of the ground. Now, another very strange thing is that the emergency responders reported, who were working around these fuming areas and the World Trade Center footprints, that their boots disintegrated after 2 hours. Why in the world would their boots disintegrate after 2 hours if there were no fires? And in the photos where they were working, there were no fires. So this is more evidence of molecular dissociation. And then there was also a news interview, a video clip, where a journalist, a TV anchor, was interviewing Dr. Tony Daher and Dr. Lincoln Cleaver on 9/11, and they're both emergency room doctors at a hospital where casualties were taken. And what they said on the air was, after noon that day, there were no more casualties who came in. And so the anchor said, "Boy, where are all the bodies?" And the two doctors just were flabbergasted. They had nothing to say to explain what happened to all the bodies, because there were no bodies. And a fireman also stated there were no bodies. He saw no bodies. So where's the kinetic energy, and where are all the bodies from 9/11? Also, William Rodriguez, who was the head janitor, he's a friend of mine, reported that there were no fires in the buildings. And then we're going to go now to
There were no fires in the building?
He reported there were no fires in the buildings. That's right.
Okay.
And
on the day of 9/11. All right.
Yeah. And so then all I'm doing is reporting what I saw on video clips and tapes, what people said. And, of course, there's conflicting information, but I just want to report what I actually saw on video clips or heard people say in interviews who were there at the time. Now, the United States Geological Survey was very involved. I'm a geoscientist. I know them very well. And there was iron present in some of the vehicles and so forth around the World Trade Center, but the beams in buildings, especially robust buildings like these two World Trade Center buildings, were made from steel. Iron rusts, but steel does not rust, and it's also stronger than iron. That's why they use it to build buildings. So,
let me just make a point. Steel is made of iron. It's iron with carbon added to it for
that's
strength.
Right.
Okay,
but it
so
doesn't rust.
You can't say that steel is not related to iron. If iron can rust, okay, but I don't want to, you know, I don't want to intrude. I'm just saying certain things. I don't want listeners to think that steel and iron are like apples and oranges, because they're really not.
But they are different physical and chemical materials.
All right, go ahead.
Now, the sample data on the dust and particles that were at the World Trade Center site is not trustworthy. The United States Geological Survey, the USGS, did collect samples at the World Trade Center, but very few. They collected no samples where those toasted cars were located, and they should have collected samples there, too. In the spectral absorption images, which are used to analyze the particle size at the World Trade Center, they indicated that the particles, the average particle size was about 1 micron. So that's 1/80th the diameter of a human hair. How do you reduce two robust 100-story buildings into particles that are 1/80th the size of a human hair? That takes huge amounts of energy. So the data from the dust samples and the way the samples were collected indicate that data is not trustworthy, and the way it was collected is not trustworthy. Now, the beam evidence, the beam weapon evidence is also at the top of the buildings. And when you look at aerial photos of the World Trade Center buildings going down, it's very, very strange that from the top of the building down, the dust cascading down like a fountain is white, but all of the dust from the top surface of the building going up into the atmosphere is black. Why do you have that color discrepancy? And in some of the photos that the media showed of the top of the building, those photos had been altered. The color had been altered. Why did they do that?
Excuse me? The color of the photos, the dust in the photos, is altered?
Yes,
I've never heard
the media
before.
Photos.
Okay. And what about the video? So you're saying the photos compared to the video show a difference?
The photos or video that was presented by the media, had the color had been altered when it was compared to the original videos or photographs that came from other sources.
Well, I think many of the sources were media sources taking videos. That's primarily what we've seen.
I don't want to talk about that right now.
Okay,
Sophia,
go
let
ahead.
Me finish this. So the in the collapse of the Seattle Dome, which was a controlled demolition, the dust did not go higher than the building, the height of the building. So why in the photos of the World Trade Center building do you have this dust cloud coming off in a stream that goes up into the upper atmosphere? That's just incredible. Someone has to explain that. Now, what is also very incriminating is that there was some physical process going on Building 1, Building 2, and Building 7. It's sort of a lathering up of the building or on the surface of the building that happened sometime before the building collapses. And it was probably the beam weapon or some kind of a physical process happening that was necessary for the beam to work properly. Now, it started on Building 7 before Building 2 went down. So they were already preparing Building 7 before Building 2 went down. And when Building 7 went down, it was not, I'm sorry, when Building 2 went down, it did not damage Building 7. There were big freon tanks full of freon and something very mysterious about them was involved. There were OSHA statements and sort of cover-up stories. We do know that Freon asphyxiates, or it's heavier than oxygen, so it pushes the oxygen out of a room or a space. So that Freon might have been involved. I need to talk to a scientist, a chemist, about that, about what might have happened. Now, that's all I'm going to say right now about the evidence at the World Trade Center, but the Minneapolis bridge collapse, which occurred just a day or two before our 9/11 Madison, Wisconsin conference, the science and politics of 9/11, it was August 3rd to 5th, 2007, and we arrived and flew in over.
Okay, Lorraine, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but we discussed the bridge in our last show, and we are running out of time. So I need to open the line up to our caller if he's still on, and if not, then I'm going to have to comment a little bit here because I don't want to take this discussion into the bridge. We decided to focus on the World Trade Center, and we have no time. So the first question I'm going to ask is our caller on the line still? I'm going to give him a sec. Yes, all right. Thank you so much for waiting. And would you like to present your question to Lorraine Murray?
It's not so much a question as much as I'm going to add to the color of this conversation. First off, thank you so much for having such a knowledgeable guest on with respect to exotic weaponry on the 9/11 incident, because it's so hard to get evidence pointing in that direction. So I really, really appreciate this interview this morning. However, I'd like to add to the point that for those folks out there that are skeptical still, there is, if you can still see it, if you can still find it on the web, there is a scene where the second a tower, whichever the tower was that collapsed, the last one, there's a section.
Building one.
Okay, there's a section there of maybe about 5, 6, 7 floors of the aluminum outside shell that is standing. And then all of a sudden, if you watch really close, it literally starts disintegrating, and it is in powderized form before those pieces actually hit the ground. It is such compelling evidence. I highly suggest you get that captured and analyze that. Now, I'll add to this that on a Dr. Fred Bell program on the BBS radio station, I was in conversation.
You have run into our 3-minute break, and we will be back in 3 minutes. Perhaps you can hold, and we'll have only a couple of minutes to wrap it up. You're listening to Expansion on Republic Broadcasting. This is Sophia, your host, and we are concluding. We're going to have a rush to conclude this, I know, our hour with Lorraine Murray explaining the electromagnetic energy signs at the World Trade Center. And I don't know if our caller is still on, but if you can devote like 30 seconds to make your last point, then we can let Lorraine conclude.
Absolutely. Thank you. And that's all I'll need, if that. Okay. Now, also, Ms. Lorraine, I'd like you to check out C4. Now, I had heard that those buildings were packed with C4 explosives. Now, I have heard that one of the chemical properties of C4 is that it creates gravity waves. Now, this may be a missing component to your energy question. Where did the energy go? Well, if it's creating gravity waves, gravity is an attractor, it could be attracting, and that's why these buildings fell so fast, is because the gravity waves help bring those buildings down through gravity faster than normal. And I'll just leave you with that, and thank you so much for your show today. Thank you.
Oh, well, thank you very, very much. You know, I get so much from the listeners and audience and citizens who give me a lot of information. Sometimes I feel like I get more information from them than they give me. And it's really very important for us as a community, even though we don't know each other, to share this information and brainstorm together. It's really exciting. I just like to read a comment that kind of sums it up. And this came off of a forum on the internet, so there's no author. We stand at the beginning of a new age. our government has in its hands a method of disrupting the molecular basis for matter, and its first impulse was to weaponize it. Is this so hard to understand? Like splitting atoms to create destruction was hard to understand in 1945. Of course, this new invention came when the United States ruled supreme. A weapon system of vast new power comes in time. We don't have an enemy worthy of it, so naturally we use it on ourselves. Wag the dog. But I want to remind the audience that HAARP was a secret, covert project developed secretly in partnership by the Soviet Union and the United States, and the main facility in the U.S. was Livermore Nuclear Weapons Lab, where I'm a whistleblower. So there is plenty of evidence that this system exists, and it's just up to us to figure out from the clues they leave behind how it's used. And certainly the World Trade Center is a very, very good example of how they are planning to use it. Thank you, Sophia.
Well, thank you, Loren, and Alfred also, who waited, I think, for this second hour without having a much contribution. And this has been interesting. I have loads of questions, points that I'd love to bring up. So someday I will do another show discussing all that I have accumulated in my research and how it fits with some of what Loren said and how it may not fit with other parts of that. But again, this is about brainstorming so that we can all arrive at a bigger understanding, an expanded understanding. So I want to thank our listeners. I want to thank Loren and Alfred, and particularly our caller who waited. And next week I will have on Charlotte Gerson and her son Howard Strauss, whose new movie is opening in Los Angeles, A Beautiful Life.